This is
Podcast Raleigh
with your hosts
Ashton and Hayes.
Raleigh is a progressive city. It is growing. We're adding cultural activities, recreational activities. Look at Dix Park. So many things to make it a more cosmopolitan city. And we're going to continue to do that. We need to continue to do that. And if we try to stifle it, it's not good.
Welcome into Podcast Raleigh. In this week's episode, we talk to Smedes York, native, current resident, and former city council member and mayor of Raleigh, on topics ranging from Raleigh's future, city issues past and present, and playing basketball for legendary NC State coach Everett Case. We also talk about Hurricane Dorian and Hopscotch in review, our hashtag top three Raleigh pizza spots, and more, all on this week's episode of Podcast Raleigh. But first, a word from our local Raleigh sponsors.
Finding a new home doesn't have to be painful. With the expert agents at Steel Residential, you'll have decades of local knowledge and experience guiding you, whether you're looking to buy, rent, or manage your property. With an office in Raleigh's Cameron Village, you can also find them online or give them a call at 919-443-5834 and start the search for your next home. Learn more at steelresidential.com. That's S-T-E-E-L-E residential.com.
If you've been to downtown Raleigh, then you've seen Express Yourself Paint's work. The Morning Times, Person Street Bar, and Oak City Meatball Shop are just a handful of the commercial painting projects Express Yourself Paint has completed. They've done restaurants, office buildings, commercial buildings, churches, apartment complexes, municipalities, and stores. They meet tight schedules, and oh yeah, they do residential too. Call 919-526-0611 or go to expressyourselfpaint.com now to request a free estimate. Be sure to tell them Podcast Raleigh sent you. We're in downtown Raleigh. It's August sticky more than September nice right now, but we're not interested by the weather. What are we interested in, Ashton? What's going on?
Well, you know, our top three this week is around pizza, so we got to start interesting things around pizza.
Good tie-in, yeah.
So Poolside Pies, Ashley Christensen's long-awaited pizza place, started serving from a takeout window during Hopscotch Music Festival this weekend. No news yet, no public news anyway, on when they will officially open.
Update, it's now open!
But there were quite a number of lines for pizza. And then Pizza La Stella on Fayetteville Street closed, rather unexpectedly. So we added one almost, and we took one away.
Do you know if the window service is something that will continue? Will they be a late night pie slot spot?
I don't get the feeling that they'll have a window. You know, sometimes like Garland opens a window for Hopscotch and things like that. So I wonder if it's a special occasion kind of thing. The physics of it didn't seem to make a whole lot of sense because It was a really big window that they were working out.
Gotcha. It did not look like It was designed to be just a service window.
No, but it would be cool if they could.
But it seems like they could crush it on Red Hat concerts.
Sure. Like, and they might just do takeout, but just not out of window, you know, that kind of thing. Yeah. And it was like a 10 or 15 minute wait, so it really wasn't bad.
Dude, I assume you have tasted and can review
this? Of course.
Do we want to save that for the hashtag?
Yes, we'll save it for the top three. Yeah.
Interesting to me in Raleigh is sort of post-hurricane world. We were dealing with it almost through the weekend. It was off the mind of most people in the Triangle by Friday afternoon and Saturday. But I think what's interesting about that to me is twofold. One, we always got to be careful when it didn't hit us bad, it still hit the coast.
Yeah.
There's still, you know, if you had planned for donations or given some time or whatever you can, there's still people that need it.
Locally and a little further away.
Yep. But also, it reminds me, and this is where I start to feel like old person, but you know, they kept talking about Fran being 23 years ago, almost to the day of Dorian as it came through. And it's a reminder that every one of these that still gets the hype, because it does. I mean, it's both important information and good news ratings. So those tie together, like everybody sort of leans into it. We were talking about it on our sports show.
Sure.
But every time one of these hyped up ones doesn't come through, I feel like we become more susceptible to the Fran coming through that I remember being 17, having no idea that a hurricane could do that much damage.
Yeah.
So I always worry when one, not that this one was supposed to hit us that bad, but every time that you talk about getting prepared for one and something doesn't affect the Triangle, that we're that a little bit less prepared for the big one that might come.
And especially with people who are moving in at the rate that they do from places that don't have hurricanes.
And if you didn't live through Fran, you'll never know. If you live through it, you'll always remember and probably always over-prepare a little bit, even when they say it's going to stay out to the coast.
Well, I think it's like the school closings. I mean, it's easier to over-announce, over-prepare, and then have it be a lesser thing than deal with the catastrophe that could happen if people are unaware.
What else is interesting to you?
So Loading Dock, one of the co-working spaces up by Whitaker Mill in Atlantic at Dock 1053, has announced they're opening a third location down in the Prince Hall District over by Shaw. So that will be really one of the kind of early co-working spaces in that neighborhood. So excited to see that. It's about a 3,000 square foot space, and they've already got a tenant in there.
Cool. Seems like more expansion down in the part of town that we've talked about with multiple people mm-hmm. that sometimes get left behind for those things. So cool to see cool new things like office sharing spaces.
Yeah.
In there as
but
well.
The NNO article, you know, talked a little bit as well about sometimes co-working spaces can be also associated with gentrification. And so while it's a real positive in a lot of ways, because we are bringing, you know, these resources in this cool kind of working space that's not in that area, how do you balance that? And are we, you know, worried about that at all?
I feel like that's a running theme in our podcast that we try and bounce off guests who know about it and do more directly with it than we do as we try and educate ourselves. One thing I found interesting, there was an article, and I believe it was WRL.com, that said, and I don't have the actual source. Maybe I'll edit that in too. But that Raleigh was ranked the 12th best state capital to live in. And I found it interesting. The headline was, but still behind Austin. we're behind 11 other people, but we seem to be always comparing ourselves to Austin. And I will say, look, some of these are great cities, but I don't believe that weather was a huge factor. Now, Honolulu was number one.
Okay, so maybe weather is a little bit of a factor.
And then it's Madison, Wisconsin, Concord, New Hampshire, Montpelier, Vermont, and then Boston, I guess, rounding out the top five. We're like,
has it snowed in all those places yet?
Yeah, probably. I'm not sure if it hasn't stopped snowing. We're still in winter, but we're about to get like the two good weeks of weather from, you know, mid-September to late September, whatever it is. But yeah, I'm like, I don't look at a lot of those places ahead of us with a ton of envy. But again, always good to be. And maybe we just get a little miffed when we're not like top three in a ranking like we are for most.
Well, and especially because we had been for so long, you know, and so many lists. And I think we're seeing a little bit slower growth and a little bit, you know, the number of people who are moving here every day.
Yep.
That's everyone's favorite statistic around election season. That number has gone down over the last couple of years. And so I don't know.
I think weather just needs to be a bit bigger factor in some of these things. Right off the top, I can tell you, I ain't moving to Vermont, okay?
No, no, Madison, Wisconsin, I'm good, thanks.
Not a better capital.
Yeah.
And what else is interesting for you?
So the John Cain Project at Smoky Hollow was up for a 40-story rezoning request. And you may recall back in episode number 5.
Look at you, number-checking episodes.
But he was like number 5. That was pretty cool. It was a great episode, but he talked to us a little bit about that project and how even though it was zoned for 40 stories, they may not need all 40 stories, but that's sort of the way our zoning breaks out. And so anyway, they got the approval on that after agreeing to include affordable housing in some ratio and degree in it. They have to still work through all those numbers a little bit to see what that's going to look like. And there is a traffic study that it kind of depends on as well, which is unusual for just a rezoning. So
Traffic becoming more of a conversation and it's a polarizing issue, right? Like some people are like, you got to have parking. And some people are like, man, don't build parking. And that's how you change things. So that's always a debate that's going to continue to be had with development.
Yeah.
Anything else interesting? A 30-second hopscotch review?
It was fantastic, despite the hurricane. And maybe including the hurricane. You know, the logistics that it require moving a show from, three shows from City Plaza to the Ritz all of that. But it was just a really great weekend. I will admit, this is the first year I have kind of tried to do the true hopscotch experience.
Jumping
around, like doing a little research ahead of time, being a little more educated. Nathan was really helpful on kind of where we needed to, you know, what not to miss, that kind of stuff. So really loved it. I mean, every single night was something great and something different. And we talk a lot, you know, amongst friends about how we love cities like Nashville and places like that, where there's always music coming out of somewhere. And so it's pretty cool to go from, you know, What Cheer Brigade, this kind of big brass band sound, to, you know, a very country sounding artist in the same night that we heard a incredible guitarist from Niger and his band. And so like all of that existing in Raleigh on the same night.
Cool.
And that's just one of three nights. Oh, also Little Brother was here that night, you know, all of these things. And so it's all of that is a really cool thing for Raleigh. And it's fun to think that we're going to roll into bluegrass and not too long as well. Got one last interesting and very important thing for you. Early voting starts in Raleigh and for Raleigh and Cary municipal elections next week. That is Wednesday the 18th. And so you can vote in a couple of different places all over the county. The best place for information about that is wakevotesearly.com. The voter registration deadline is this Friday, the 13th. But great news, if you need to change your registration, maybe you're not registered yet, you can actually do that during early voting. But that's the catch. You have to vote during early voting if you need to update or register to vote in order to do that. Again, more information at wakevotesearly.com. You can check your voter registration there, figure out the closest place to you if you want to early vote, if you need to request an absentee ballot, because like me, you know you're not going to be in town on election day. You can go ahead and take care of that, and we will keep reminding you as we get closer about all these important deadlines.
This week's hashtag top three Raleigh might be one of our most popular, one of our most contentious. There's no way that Ashton and I will please everyone with our picks. And like always, we'll probably disappointingly share too many of the same ones. But it is hashtag top three Raleigh pizza spots.
Yeah.
We got a ton of good nominees.
And we didn't narrow it down too much either, because that's the hard thing about pizza is people want really different things in a pizza. Like if you want a Neapolitan style, you're probably not going to love a New York pizza place the same way.
Right.
So we left this one kind of open. Maybe in the future we like really drill down into best New York slice or best
whatever else. We're not New York. We're not some big city that trades on pizza. I think we can put our arms around all kinds of pizza.
But I'm just saying, if somebody says what's the best pizza and they're looking for a different kind of pizza, you're going to give them the wrong answer.
I feel you.
So we got a bunch of the same answers. Let's see. Oakwood Pizza Box was a popular favorite.
Yep.
Capital Creations, also a popular favorite.
Long time winner.
Yeah, Bella Monica got a couple of nominations. Mellow Mushroom surprised me with a few nominations as well, just because it's a little chain. I didn't expect that.
Chain with a local feel.
Yeah. And then we got a whole bunch that are people's names. We got Frank's, Lily's, Nancy's, Vic's, Randy's, and Jet's, which I really never noticed that as a theme amongst pizza places, but now we know. And I think actually Andy's was also, and Clausey's were two RIP nominations that we got.
Andy's just the North Hills place. Clausey's was a truck
food truck,
only,
yeah,
right?
I think so. Moonlight Pizza was another RIP, and so was Pizza America. We also got mentions for, that may be it.
Piccolo Italia.
Oh, yep. Got that one.
Mm-hmm. New York Pizza, or now Slice of New York.
It's called Slice of New York. It used to be I Love New York or I Heart New York.
And if you knew it as that, it's still that.
Right. It's still the same place, but it's funny. They only changed the beginning of the sign, so it's like two different fonts on it too. But it's still the same place. It's still big. I think there's still one in Chapel Hill and one in Raleigh, and serving college students late night pizza.
Yep.
But when I was in school, when we got off-campus lunch, you could get over there and get a slice and a drink for like $3.25 or something crazy.
In addition to giving my hashtag top three Raleigh picks, I feel like I want to give like all my pizza takes.
Yeah.
Like, I miss Moonlight the place, but I thought their pizza was a little bit overrated. It had a good culture. And also, I feel the need to say things when I have a negative opinion so that we're not just seen as only
sunshine. Their ownership did change towards the end of their
life. That could
life,
be part of it.
So.
And also, because it wasn't my favorite, doesn't mean it still can't be someone's number one spot.
And it was
spot,
a great neighborhood spot for a long time.
Yeah. But I'll try not to offer all of my pizza takes. I'll just give my hashtag top three.
Okay.
Do you want me to give mine?
Yeah, go ahead.
I feel like you often are burdened with going first. My number one right now is Oakwood Pizza Box.
Yeah.
It's in my fridge. Until I had a dog that took us out of going there a bunch because we like to sit at the bar and not sit outside as much. It's a cool vibe, cool spot of town, and most importantly, excellent pizza. Their circle pie, their square pie. They do pop-up dinners that I actually don't want to mention because then more people will be looking out for them and they sell out fast. But just an incredible place, incredible pizza. I would ride for Oakwood Pizza Box. It's my number one.
Okay.
My number two is Lily's.
Okay.
It's longstanding. Plan on the wait. It's not always the fastest.
Sure, sure. Also got a number of mentions.
Yeah. Not always the fastest. And I just, but it was there before. It was there before Raleigh was as cool as it is now, and it had culture and it was cool, and I'll always remember that. So Lily's is a top spot.
It's funny
for
that
me.
You say that. I was talking to some people about our top three this weekend and asking them kind of what their thoughts were, and the Lily's came up, and someone even made the comment that it kind of depended on who was working as to whether the pizza was as good as they wanted it to be or not.
Yeah,
and they hadn't quite identified who made the best pizza yet, but they knew sometimes when they would walk in, it'd be just a little bit of a different experience.
Expect on beer special nights for them to be out of the beers that are on special. You know, there's just you got to live with the quirks of Lily's Pizza. And then my third is kind of a sneak one that was not nominated. I'm actually a big Amedio's Pizza fan.
Ooh, you're right.
They do a thick crust and they tell you flat out, it's going to be a little bit longer waiting for this. but it's tasty. That's what I like that about Lily's. Oakwood isn't thick, but they have the perfect combination of crust and sauce to me. But I kind of like a thicker pizza. I've actually been meaning to check out Nancy's, which is Chicago style, I think, or at least they have that. So I could mention some other favorites in Hashtag Top 3. I like Frank's a lot. My RIP, if I could have one, would be Pizza Inn.
Yeah.
I miss Pizza.
Are they all gone?
No, they're not all gone, but I'm pretty sure all the ones in Raleigh proper are gone. There's like a Garner one, a Durham one, a couple other ones, but they used to be just a great place to get a buffet, mow through some slices. You could basically request a pizza to be on the buffet, so just pay the buffet.
Didn't they have chocolate pizza?
Get your own pizza, and then, yes, they do, Ashton. They have great... I haven't gotten to like anyone else's dessert pizza, but I had an affinity for not only the chocolate chip pizza, but like, yes, the chocolate pizza, which is basically just chocolate pudding on a pizza. So I miss all of the Pizza Inns that used to be around, but we still got good pizza. Yeah. What you got?
All right. So you mentioned my first one as well. And these are all kind of like not in any particular order because it really depends on what I'm in the mood for.
All right.
But Oakwood Pizza Box is still my kind of go-to on that. Love that spot. And not just like good crust and sauce, but those little perfectly cupped little pepperonis.
Yeah, yes.
They're amazing.
Everything's good.
Trophy is obviously a favorite for me. Got a couple of nominations
and
as well.
And on Monday nights, they've got that
Detroit
pizza.
Style.
It goes fast. I've only had it like twice because I play basketball on Monday night and I can't get over there fast enough.
Yeah, and that's so I live quite close to it. So Trophy is a regular spot for me. One that didn't get a lot of nominations and was a little bit of a surprise, Molino. The Italian spot right there on North Dawson where it kind of comes into downtown. And I'll tell you how we kind of discovered it. Back in, I think, January, seven friends and I went on a pizza tour through the Triangle. We decided like kind of the best, and we kind of tried to focus more Neapolitan style pizza, but we picked a couple of places in like Carrboro and Durham and in Raleigh. We laid out the criteria and we each judged and weighted each one. Things like, you know, the distribution of ingredients, the quality of ingredients.
Is there a blog where I can find this?
It's actually all on my Instagram.
Or at least a Google Doc. Okay. So
but their results are all out there too. And we had one kind of late add to the day, and that was Molino. And it was only a surprise because I love their Italian food. I just never would have thought of it as a pizza place.
Yeah.
But it was, I mean, we included even things like price per square foot, because sometimes that's a big factor. You know, how far am I willing to drive for something is an important thing.
Gotcha.
But yeah, and so that was a fun thing that we did. And so I feel like I'm really like up to...
You're a pizza expert.
I'm up on pizza now, at least Neapolitan style pizza. Yeah. And not to add to my own credibility here.
No, please.
But as you know, I spent 2 years living in Italy.
Ah, that's right.
So I care a lot about pizza.
I have no credibility. Mine's if it tastes really good and they treat it as cool, then we probably will just keep going back to the same place.
Yeah, but so here's the thing. And going back to my original point, like... I know that I'm not going to find the same pizza in Raleigh that I found in Italy.
Sure.
Trophy is not even trying to be a Neapolitan pizza. And so part of it's about expectation. And like, again, what do you want in a pizza?
Yeah, I want Oakwood Pizza Box. That's what
I want. Yeah, me too. Back in a minute with more Podcast Raleigh.
Podcast Raleigh is supported by Express Yourself Paint, Raleigh's premier residential and commercial painting contractor. Call 919-526-0611 or go online to expressyourselfpaint.com to schedule your free painting estimate. And include Podcast Raleigh in the referral code. You get great paint service and we get paid. It's a win-win.
The Triangle housing market can feel crazy right now, whether you're buying, selling, or renting. You need the expert agents at Steel Residential to help you find your best home. Located in Cameron Village, they can help you buy, sell, rent, or manage your property. Call 919-443-5843 or visit steelresidential.com to learn more. That's STEELE residential.com.
Smeeds York is inextricably linked with the city of Raleigh. He is a native, a former mayor, a member of the Raleigh Hall of Fame, a longtime member of the NC State Board of Trustees, and he's held innumerable leadership positions for projects, charities, fundraising efforts, and more in the city. He even wrote a book entitled Growing Up with Raleigh, and he has another book about Raleigh on the way. We talked to him about a range of topics, but we started with his earliest memories of the city he's so connected to.
Well, I was born in 1941, and I remember actually the end of World War II, which goes way back. But Raleigh was considered a sleepy southern capital city of about 40 to 50,000 people.
Wow.
So obviously it's grown tremendously over the years, but I would say I tell people, I like it better now than I did years ago. And the reason is so much more to do. Recreational opportunities, cultural opportunities, more diversity of people. So I think it's getting better, but you have to work at it.
And what about on the flip side? What have you seen negative changes, things that you missed from 1940? Do we lose anything not being the sleepy town anymore?
I think that what worries me is beginning of a lack of civility. I think, in my way of thinking, civility is one of the most important words in our language and the most important thing to have, and to show there's not a political statement. When John Edward was elected to the U.S. Senate and Jesse Helms was already a senator, and they were opposite politically. And when John Edwards went up, Jesse showed him all around, showed him the ropes. And I guess it was the News Observer asked, why did you do that? And Jesse said, I believe in civility. And I think as we, you've seen it even on the city council now, you're not having the civility and people embracing each other, talking to each other. So I remember Avery Upchurch had a campaign, he was former mayor, also drive friendly. It's not happening a lot. There's some changes like that, and I don't know exactly how to combat it, but I think it's important that we think about it and see what we can do about that. So I would say that's the main thing. It's certainly more people and more traffic, but that's a sign of prosperity. I mean, that's what you want. The opposite mm-hmm. of that is people rushing to get out of town and the population going down and, you know, housing stock going down. So I'd say lack of civility or lessening of civility.
What do you think has created that?
I think you're seeing it at the national level to a large extent, except I think the lack of civility or lessening of civility started before the last 3 years. So I think it's just a little bit of crowding, a little bit of pushing, a little bit of being in a hurry, but we need to step back a little bit and think about that. Sidney Lowe was a basketball coach at NC State a few years ago, and I know him fairly well. But when he came, he told a story about he was walking down Western Boulevard, not in the street. There's a sort of a greenway or sidewalk along sure. Western Boulevard, and he saw somebody coming the other direction. He said, oh, my goodness, you know, he sort of tensed up. And the person came by and said, hey, Sidney, how you doing? You know, he just said, well, I know I'm in a different place. But we need to keep that. I think that's very important. We're a southern city, hospitality, being kind to people, I think is really, really critical.
And do you think that we still have, you've talked before about the importance of compromise. Mm-hmm. Do you think that we still have a spirit of compromise in the area?
It's maybe not quite what it was, but it hasn't always been a great spirit of compromise. I've always believed in trying to build a consensus.
Yeah.
And as a former elected official and mayor, I always felt like half a loaf is better than none at all. I always felt like that. You could not necessarily get everything you want, but if you could get a lot of what you want and improve the current situation. So I think Isabella Cannon was the mayor when I was first elected to the city council, and she's actually the person I defeated. We can talk about that later, but she didn't believe in the compromise. So there were 8 people on the council, and she was in a block of 2. You don't get anything done when there's 6 votes against most of what you're trying to do. But many times she could have compromised and gotten something. So I think it's important to compromise. I don't know that particularly is not as good as it used to be, but I certainly think, or for example, Miriam Block was on the council with me,
mm-hmm.
and we didn't agree on very much, but we had the friendliest, I mean, she was an NC State fan like I am. And
easier to get along with those people.
Yeah, easier to get along with those people. We joke around and that sort of thing. So that's what we really, really need in Raleigh. Raleigh is people working with people, and certainly you're going to have compromises, building consensus, but it takes work.
Yeah, it sounds like more of a sense of camaraderie, a sense of we're on the same team, kind of being a team player.
That's right. And you can be on the team, and I tell people I played a lot of sports. Hayes, you played a lot of sports, but Ashton, you have too. But the most sort of rough times I would have would be in practice, because you'd be pushing each other in practice trying to get a starting position. But once you got the other team against the other team, you're 100% together. So I don't mean you don't have that, but at the same time, you need to come together and have a sort of a series of objectives that you've worked on together.
You have not only one name that's well known in Raleigh, your last name, York, but even your first name, Smeeds. Mm-hmm. So you have two sort of heavy names, Smeeds, York. You've obviously done a lot and have your own legacy. When did you sort of first learn the legacy of your name and how much it meant to the city and your neighbors?
Well, I was growing up, my father, I was 8 years old when Cameron Village opened, so I remember it being built. And I always thought that that's really a big thing. In 1949 is when it opened. And I never forget, my father had a plaque in our kitchen that said, "God bless our mortgaged home." I thought, why do we have to mortgage our home? I thought we were doing so great building this Cameron Village. So I've always felt a sense of being a part of the community, and father was in a lot of leadership positions, but his father also was. His father started the company, Charles V. York, in 1910. And he was quite a developer, quite an entrepreneur, a builder. So he had, the legacy goes all the way back to 1910. So it was a natural thing for me. And it's just kind of a, well, definitely a coincidence that I'm the person within our family that had the name Smeeds. And of course, York, all of us had the last name York, but the Smeeds. And of course, the Smeeds goes back to St. Mary's School, mm-hmm. and which was founded in 1842. Mm-hmm. So it goes way back.
So did you ever have a choice about going into the family business?
Yes, I definitely had a choice, but I never had any interest in doing anything else. In fact, my older brother is a physicist and really a world-known physicist, relativity physics. He never had much interest in going into the family business, but I never wanted to do anything else. And my father encouraged that. I guess he wanted that to be the case, but I was a budding entrepreneur going all the way back to when I was 5 years old living on Maiden Lane, which is right across from the Bell Tower. That area is being redeveloped now. But I actually had three businesses going. I was selling rabbits for a dollar, and not for people to eat. These were pet
rabbits.
Where'd
you get the rabbits?
I can't remember where we got the rabbits, but we raised them and we'd sell them. And then I would sell comic books down on the corner, for a dime. This was actually during the Second World War. And so the other one, of course, was, not of course, but the other one was cutting grass. And my father bought me a lawnmower. And I would cut grass in the neighborhood and get paid for that. And that was probably the only one of the three that anybody really wanted. I don't think they wanted the old comic books or they might have wanted the rabbits. But so my father encouraged that, and I really wanted to do it. I went to NC State, studied civil engineering because we have a construction company, but then I wanted to get an MBA. But I never wanted to do anything else.
Did you feel like, because of your father being such a pillar in the community, that going into the family business didn't just mean working at the family business, but kind of becoming a Raleigh citizen and sort of locking in to being a person who was going to contribute to this city?
I thought a lot about that, and I think the main reason I ran for city council and mayor is I wanted to do something in my own name and in my own way that perhaps my father wouldn't have done or wouldn't have been able to do. Now, he was on the school board, but that was an appointed position. But to get elected, to run and get elected, is a very challenging and very stressful situation. And I used to talk about Floyd Patterson, the boxer, and he always had a disguise. So if he lost, he put on his disguise and leave town. That's the way I felt, being known, family known when I ran for city council and if I lost. But fortunately for me, I won and then ran against Isabella Cannon. And she was a mayor that was elected ran against Jack Coggins. And she was elected in 77. And in 79, I didn't know she was going to run again. Jack Coggins was a great, smart guy, but he loved a controversy. He loved argument. He tried to get rid of the CACs and all kind of stuff. So Isabella Cannon defeated him. She entered the race at the last minute, but she wasn't indicating she was going to necessarily run again. So I went ahead and said I was going to run for mayor. And then the last few days, she said she was running. So it was quite a campaign of opposites. I was, I think, 38. She was 75. I used to think that was old. She was 75, and of course, she's a woman. I'm a guy, a man. I was 6'4". I don't think she ever went above 5 feet, maybe right in that range.
Yeah, that iconic photo of the two of you.
Right. So anyway, that was sort of a challenge, but my father never really pushed me to be in the business, but he encouraged me, and I wanted to be in the business.
What about aside from elected stuff, and I think we will talk more about that, but did you just feel like if you went into the family business, that meant you need to not just earn your income from the family business, but you need to contribute to the Raleigh society in a way? Was that sort of part of the job description?
Well, part of it, but a key part of it was also that the business would grow, not just be a legacy person that came in and was more or less a caretaker. So one of my philosophies is a successful business is a growing business, and a growing business is a successful business. It's pretty hard to stay exactly even because you're either going to go forward or backward. But the community involvement, I remember when I got out of graduate school in 1968, I got an MBA over at UNC, and the first thing I was asked to help in was the Raleigh Little Theater. And Vic Bell, who was the top guy, Vic Bell, his son, is active in things, but this was his father. He was sort of vice president or president of the Raleigh Little Theater. So he asked me to be membership chairman. And so I was very eager to get things done in the community. I also got sort of involved in the Y sort of at the same time. But the Raleigh Little Theater, there was a fellow that was going to be the president after DeVetta Steed. DeVetta Steed had followed after, I think, Vic Bell. But they fired DeVetta Steed, and I was in her voting block, so to speak, fired the artistic director. And so we hired somebody else. But that was when Jim Dorsett, he was going to be the president, got moved to Winston-Salem. He was an attorney for Wachovia. Then I became the president. So that was the most controversial year of my life in terms of any civic thing or any governmental thing. But I learned some great, great lessons.
Yeah.
It was about to go under. Raleigh Little Theater started in like 1936, I think. So this would have been like 1970. So it had been, you know, it was, but I didn't want it to go under while I was president.
Sure.
So every once in a while with the payroll, I'd sort of ease over a little contribution and that sort of thing. But so I don't think it was something that I was expected to do. I wanted to do it. I think a lot of it had to do, I didn't know I was ever going to outdo my father, but in a certain competitive way, I wanted to do things to show that I was not just some legacy.
And I'm sure it didn't hurt growing up with parents who were involved in the community, seeing that and that being just a part of your natural kind of life.
Definitely opened doors. And I always would say it opened doors, but I would have to walk through them. They could open the doors. But the last thing I wanted to do was be a flunky in terms of, you've seen the type of person that has the opportunity that doesn't really take advantage of it.
Yeah.
So I wanted to make things work, and that Raleigh Little Theater, I could go into that for a long time. The next book, which is will be coming out, called Raleigh, What We Remember, is going to have a long episode about the Raleigh Little Theater. So you wait till that comes out.
We're looking forward to that. So you mentioned campaigning and how much work goes into that, and we're in the middle of campaign season here in Raleigh. So what are some of the differences between campaigning then and campaigning now, and were the issues similar or different?
The overriding issue is the same, which is dealing with growth. In the early 70s, the election system that we have today in the city changed in 1973. Okay. Prior to that, there were 7 members of the city council. They were all elected at large. They could all live next door to each other. But it was changed through a referendum, but nevertheless, it was changed. So the reason it was the push to change it, there was a lot of neighborhood-type leaders, and of course, you want to be a neighborhood leader, but a lot of folks that maybe in that description would also be very no-growth-oriented. So there were just a lot of back and forth. What kind of city does Raleigh want to be? So the issue having to do with growth versus no growth. There was work going on the comprehensive plan in the early, from 73. And some of us got together and said, we got to do more than just have input. Some of us have to run for the city council and be on the council. So that was the main issue. So I think that issue is going to be with us as long as we're growing. And it's an important issue. And we've done things well here in Raleigh. When people say that growth planning hasn't been done well. It actually has been done well. I mean, this is one of the great cities in the country, and I'm a little biased, obviously, but an example I give, which is sort of a example most people wouldn't think about, but if you ride out Glenwood Avenue, which is out past Crabtree, and keep going, you basically do have strip development heading up to the Angus Barn. Mm-hmm. But if you compare that type of strip development, the reason there's strip development there, the county had a zoning category called Highway District that was 500 feet on each side of a main thoroughfare. So you could do anything in a highway district except a house. So it's sort of strange. So nevertheless, if you look at that kind of development, which is strip-type development, but we have sort of sidewalks on each side, sort of winding sidewalks. You have one sign per business. You have the size of the sign is limited, and it's really not so unpleasant. And if you ride into some cities, you just see two or three signs per business and that sort of thing. So that kind of planning is sort of the small part of planning, but the overall master planning, the comprehensive plan, was not able to be adopted in the early 70s. Some of us got on the council. I'm not trying to take too much credit here, but we developed a comprehensive planning committee that was actually in June of 79, we delivered a comprehensive plan where there had been a committee put together of 16 people, four from the city council, four from the planning commission, four from Citizens Advisory Council, and four from an organization called PROD, Progress of Raleigh Through Order Development, 16 people. So both the development community and the neighborhood community and even to some extent the university community was represented. We ended up getting and actually Isabella Cannon appointed me chairman of that committee, but she was on it, at least she was ad hoc on it. But anyway, we got a unanimous vote there, unanimous vote at the Planning Commission, unanimous vote at City Council. So you can work together.
Yeah, absolutely. So what was the challenge in having the comp plan approved in 1973?
It was too restrictive. They had something, the leaders at that time, I could give the names, I don't know if that would help any, but they had something called the Yellow Pages. And the Yellow Pages were so restrictive, if adopted, for example, they would say a neighborhood center, all right, it would have to be no more than so many square feet. And then even to the extent the barbershop could only be 1,200 feet. I mean, it was really, they had three columns. Each column was more restricted. And one of the council people, his credit, was saying, I didn't hear him say it, but the way to stop growth is not to pave the streets. So there was a lot of that going on.
That does feel familiar. Yeah.
Yeah. That was a lot of that going on. So Tony Jordan, I love Tony. He died a year or so ago. He and I decided to run and were fortunate to get elected. And we developed a sort of a working majority. Raleigh is a progressive city. It is growing. We're adding cultural activities, recreational activities. Look at Dix Park. Ashton's involved with that. But just so many things to make it a more cosmopolitan city. And we're going to continue to do that. We need to continue to do that. And if we try to stifle it, it's not good. And it's not positive. And it really won't work. It won't work. So it's a lot of planning we need to do for growth. It's not just a matter of growing, but it's a matter of, for example, the last 15 years, the move to the urban core is a really positive thing. It's really positive. And gosh, there's so much construction going on, but if you have X number of people moving to an area, I used to say you could have urban sprawl, you could go way out, or you could have some density in the right places. Or I would say, how many of you have an extra bedroom? You want some of these people to move in with you.
So, yeah.
So the point is, the urban core, the move where the most valuable properties are the closest to the center, is a great thing for a city.
Well, and so Cameron Village was one of the first planned urban developments in this part of the country, and that included a variety of housing types, office, retail, community amenities. Do you think that growing up with that kind of shaped your perspective on how cities should function?
I think most definitely it did. And my father was a lot of intestinal fortitude to do that, but he got an example through the Urban Land Institute, through Mr. J.C. Nichols in Country Club Plaza in Kansas City, which still a thriving center, but there were no malls in 49, so it was laid out in blocks. And But to seeing that and all, I think that had a lot to do with it. But for a long time, when I was ran for mayor, one of my sort of three goals was a downtown development. But it really wasn't happening.
It took a little time.
Yeah, it took a lot of time. Charles Meeker finally got in there and got a lot happening, but maybe we were laying a base, at least in terms of it being a priority. But it really wasn't happening. So Cameron Village did really well from 49 through the end of the 50s and the 60s. And then when the malls opened, North Hills was converted to a mall. It's no longer a mall at all. But when it was converted in 67 and then Crabtree opened in 72, see, Cameron Village from 70s and the 80s didn't do as well. So that wasn't the day of the urban type movement. But now, it's sort of like neckties, you know, they go change sizes and shape and stuff. We're back in style, and that's people right. love eating, you know, sidewalk dining and that sort of thing. So through the years, but certainly that example and my father showing me all of that and talking to it, he would talk about, he'd sweat through sheets and all kind of stuff. He helped a lot of businesses get started, but it was a great urban model. And today, that model would be even more successful, but it's hard to build to that model today because of the storefront parking and that sort of thing.
I miss Baskin Robbins. I miss Ballantyne's. I'm curious, is there one store or restaurant that has been in Cameron Village that's been your favorite that's no longer there, one that you miss the most?
I'd say Ballantyne's. We have a lot more diversity of restaurants now, but yeah. Ballantyne's was
there's
was
great ones there.
Great restaurant. And Red Ballantyne, his son Johnny Ballantyne's. Their concept was terrific. There was a period that it was sort of marginal. I mean, it was a period. It wasn't something we wanted to see leave. You know, there's only one. There's no store in the village that was there in the beginning. The store that's been there the longest is Madeline Davis, the cleaner. So my father said, a shopping center is not a business, it's not a real estate, it's a career. And the only thing I would change is that it's more than one career. It's his career, my career, and George's career. But you've got to keep changing it. And some of the changes you want to make, need to make, some of them, and particularly in the 70s, we didn't really want to make.
What about the underground? Will we see that reopen?
That's the most exciting thing I've been involved in my involvement going back to the early 70s. And we had the idea that we'd heard about Underground Atlanta. So Hal Worth and Nan Hutchins and I visited Underground Atlanta. We had all this space that was under a department store called Boylan Pierce, B-O-Y-L-A-N. They're still there, signed downtown, yeah. But the store's not there. But my father, when he built the Boylan Pierce, he had a basement the same size as the store, and also it would take another floor the same size as the store. So they never expanded and never wanted to expand. So we got excited about it, and we worked up a plan. The architect was Leif Ballin and Associates, but Nelson Benzing, he worked with him. He drew these stores with interior corridors, and it was so exciting. And it worked generally well for a while, but the small stores didn't flourish down there. So through time, we changed into more restaurants and more night spots. But they weren't really making money. The Frog and Nightgown was probably the most famous one. And my father and I did everything we could to keep them in business. I mean, they're great folks. And we even bought their equipment and leased it back, all kinds of things. But it was just a tough, tough go. But we do have a plan to bring back one underground, we call it the Village Subway, a tavern, a night spot, a music venue, not a restaurant.
Okay.
And we've got the team that's going to do it. We've got some work to do still with the negotiation with the Fresh Market in terms of access and all, but it's going to happen, and I'm going to be mainly the tenant, I mean, also the landlord. But I have a team, Will Alfin, who has the foundation downtown, is sort of a key person. And so we got it generally designed.
Okay.
He's a builder too. So,
yeah.
You know, people hear an idea and, I'd like it to be open now. I mean, we've been talking about it for a couple of years.
Yeah, what's the timeline?
It takes persistence. I hope it'll be open next year.
Okay.
In 2020. We we got the plan. We've got to get this access. When the subway was there and operating, you could enter it on the side where the steps going down from just the sidewalk. But then in the Clark Avenue side, halfway out in the parking lot, there was what we call the subway house. And it had a marquee and it had big wide steps. That tunnel, which is, goes half under the parking lot on the side where the library is still there.
Okay.
So
just need to reopen it.
Yeah, need to reopen it.
Any chance you would use the same old name, Frog and Nightgown, or will this be called Smead's Tavern?
That's a proprietary thing. In fact, somebody that mentioned that somehow got in the news, and Peter Ingram, who was the proprietor along with his wife, Robin Ingram, he made it clear that that wasn't something, but that wasn't my idea anyway. Yeah. I wasn't going to do that anyway.
You talked about some of the issues you faced on the city council and how some of them sounded similar. I'm curious, and you mentioned specifically your the campaign against Isabella Cannon, just a campaign of opposites. But what did campaigning look like in the 70s and 80s? You didn't have a website, and no social media. Was it
fortunately we didn't have that? But I say fortunately because same thing. You're trying to contact people, and we put together certainly a precinct organization, but in running for office, this thing like birds of a feather flock together. I mean, precincts in parts of town generally vote similarly. Mm-hmm. I mean, whether they vote like you want them to vote or not, I mean, generally. So the campaign was structured to go after the precincts that were naturally for me probably anyway.
Yeah.
And not to get the other folks angry, you know, at me. But so it was a lot of phone calls, we did a lot of get out the vote in precincts that we knew we were going to win. And ones we would lose, we'd say, don't vote. No, we didn't say that. But that's the point. So the get out the vote, but a lot of mailing, a lot of postcards, but raise a lot less money. One thing I did, I knew Isabella would say that I was using all my rich friends, you know, and putting my own money in the campaign and all. So to counter that, I put a limit. Now, this is hard to believe, but it's totally true. $25 per person, max.
Wow.
Max. And I figured I needed $25,000 to $30,000 to run the campaign. So I had 1,000, essentially ended up with 1,000 contributors at $25. But the good thing about that, if they contributed, they were probably going to vote for me. But even that, they didn't, they being Isabella and her campaign manager, my good friend Jack Nichols, even they said that somehow I was using my so-called rich friends. But
That sounds like a very modern idea of right now. Yeah. You know, that's like a Bernie Sanders type thing. Just get a lot of people just contribute, and then they'll be buying into your campaign.
And then also, again, campaign to your strength. When I ran for city council, not mayor, but I ran against a very fine person who worked for Nationwide Insurance named Bob Gardner. And District E had, like, as I recall, it might have had 16 precincts, but three of them were outside the Beltline, Lake Boone area, which I was not as well known there. And Bob was from that area. So I figure I might break even there or might lose a little bit, but we've got precincts like precinct 3, 5, 11 that I should get a big percentage. You know, he never had a winning strategy, in my opinion. We had a strategy to go after folks that would naturally be supportive. And when going back to the district system, which came, as we said, in 73, I wasn't necessarily a proponent of doing that, but once it happened, the District E was tailor-made. You grew up in District E. It was tailor-made. If I couldn't win in District E, no way I could win citywide. So that was, but the campaign wasn't too different than it is today. Just a lot less money. And certainly you don't have the social media, but yard signs were the big thing, and they're still pretty big.
Yeah. So with that change in the districts, moving from there being everyone elected at large to having districts put in, do you think that was a positive move for the city? And sort of what was the driving force behind that?
In retrospect, I think it was positive. At the time, I didn't really think so. And the sitting city council at that time didn't vote for it because they would be voting themselves out. But the driving force was that you could run for office in a district system a lot with a lot less expense and organization than running citywide. So instead of having to run citywide, you could run just from a district. And the neighborhood leaders, and I hate to use that word because I'm a neighborhood leader too, but maybe to understand the ones that would be thought of that way only, they were in a much better position to get elected. And that was the driving force. And once it, like I say, once it happened, I thought about running in 73. And 71 was the last election under the previous system. I thought about running then also. There were seven, and one of the all the incumbents were going to run. It turned out C.B. Jones didn't. He dropped out after his name was on the ballot. That's sort of tedious history. But my dad not only was against it, he precluded it.
Oh, wow.
I was just working. Just started out of graduate school. But so I think the district system has been really good.
Yeah.
I don't know any real changes necessary. I know there's some discussion about adding a ninth member. We actually tried to add a ninth member, a third at-large member. And there's been some discussion about four-year terms instead of two-year terms. But if it was up totally to me, I wouldn't change any of it.
Well, and even thinking about how many more people have moved to Raleigh in that time. I mean, at that point, you're talking about, you know, quite a few fewer people who live in these districts, and now we're asking the district representatives to represent in a whole lot more people. And so, yeah, does it ever make sense to have additional people or to rearrange the districts? Because I think they were initially carved out such that everyone had a little bit of a piece of downtown.
That was sort of the issue. I don't think the North Raleigh one maybe just barely touched, but there's a rationale for that. Maybe adding a district or two is a rationale for adding it large. Right now, any citizen votes for four members of the eight.
Yeah.
So
that's it's only half.
Only half. So, but I don't, it's going to be really interesting what happens this election. I think the ebb and flow of sort of growth, no growth, and planning and that, I think that is going to continue. And I think you have an opportunity to shift one way or the other, depending on how the community feels with the current system. So I don't think that the current system precludes good things happening, or more or less things that you don't want to happen.
Yeah. And so what kind of qualities are you looking for in this next city council and in the next mayor?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the mayor needs to have two or three goals, objectives that are crystal clear what they want to accomplish. I think Nancy McFarlane did a good job, a very good job, but she's associated with Dix Park. I mean, you can't just say, I want to be a good listener or I want to be communicate. You've got to have something you're for. So I think if a mayor would have two or three or four, I think four is a max sort of goals, because if you can't remember in a quick little speech while you're running,
sure,
it's pretty bad. So three or four things. But then you need to be able to, we talked about compromise, to get folks to come together, try to build a consensus, and not alienate folks that don't 100% agree with you. But the mayor needs to be the leader. And in our system, the mayor has the same vote as everybody else on the council, but the mayor has the opportunity to be the leader, put out some goals, and the community feels like the mayor should be the leader. So I just, Isabella really, to me, never really had any goals. She had some negative things, but I mean, I got along fine with her. When she passed away, I was at the funeral. I spoke at the funeral, got everybody laughing about some of the things she said.
You mentioned some of the reasons why you decided to get involved in city council, and you mentioned one of your first involvement opportunities was at Raleigh Little Theater. Right. Imagine between Raleigh Little Theater and now 2019, you've had a lot of requests for things to spend your time and or money in. How do you decide which invitations to accept, which things to get involved with philanthropically or volunteer-wise?
It has mostly to do with what, if I think I can actually help in that particular organization, and if people are on a board, they almost need to have a specialty within that board that they can actually help and not just be a member that sometimes shows up and that sort of thing. So being able to do something very specific. One of the boards I've been on for many years is North Carolina Amateur Sports. You're probably familiar, yeah. Maybe both of you, but we put on the Olympic Festival in 1987, but I've been on it the whole time. And we were on life support for a long time, and now it's flourishing. So that's a great sense, I'm not giving myself credit, I'm just saying sticking with things sometimes. And where I could help is when we go call on, have a contact with maybe the governor, when Governor Hunt was governor, and then helping make contacts with when we have a state games. Now we do the state games in North Carolina. In Winston-Salem, I might know a Kelly King, who's the top guy at BB&T. He used to, in fact, he headed a water and sewer bond issue when I was mayor. So I'd call a Kelly and say, we need somebody. So those kind of things. So where I can help, I'm involved with the Contemporary Art Museum now, and we're going through a rezoning. You get a chance to redevelop that property, so maybe I can have some help, you know, help some there. But I'm more of a generalist. If it's good, I'm for it. But the Raleigh Little Theater taught me a lot, and I'm still on the advisory board. In fact, we had a meeting there last Thursday at 5:00 on the advisory board.
You're still on the board there?
Advisory board.
Gotcha.
Yeah, but we still contribute, but just learned a lot. Yeah. How mean-spirited some people could be.
And so if there are people who are listening who want to be more involved in the city, who want to find a nonprofit or an organization to work with, what advice would you give them?
Well, to be involved with a city or county, but let's talk about the city board or commission, that's a good starting place. And the way to do that is to be a supporter of a council person and have a council person want you to be on, say, the Parks Commission. And then eventually it'll take 5 votes. But there's a trade-off, you know, that you say, well, you vote for my person, you vote this person. So you need to more than just fill out a sheet saying how qualified you are. It's a little bit of a political, possibly political type process. So other than that, just find something you have a passion for. And I say once you work your way up, but show up, do what you say you're going to do. And there are a lot of boards and commissions and nonprofits and charities. I mean, there's plenty of opportunities, but hopefully it's competitive for some of the good ones. And so there are a lot of opportunities, but I think a board or commission with the city is a great way to start community involvement. And Ashton, you're on the Dix Park. I mean, that's a great opportunity. That's going to be with us forever, hopefully.
Yeah. Yeah, well, in my experience working with boards and commissions, one of the interesting things about being a younger person in that environment is the opportunity to learn from people who have been involved since the beginning and things like that. So, yeah, in my experience, it's certainly worth it.
But that learning is definitely a two-way street. I mean, somebody that's got the experience may not have the ability to do some of the things that some of the younger people know how to do. So this working together is what makes it work.
This is Podcast Raleigh, not my sports radio show, but because you're from Raleigh and you played your college basketball in Raleigh, I do have to ask. So NC State basketball coach Everett Case, just a well-known figure, not only locally, but sort of gets credit for the bringing the ACC into sort of the mainstream knowledge. So he was known as not only a great coach, but a great promoter too, coming up with different events and things. Did you see the promoter side, or did you just see him as a coach and let him do all that other stuff out in the public?
Well, growing up in Raleigh and loving NC State, my dad went to NC State. I went to basketball games. I went to some basketball games, actually a Southern Conference tournament game, which would have been in the late 40s, in Memorial Auditorium. It used to have a flat floor.
Yep.
And then many games in Frank Thompson, which now is the theater. But so I grew up being an NC State fan and wanting to play basketball for NC State. We had a full court at our house and that sort of thing. So I saw him more as the ultimate in basketball. NC State won most of the championships in the 50s. And so but certainly as I understood more about things, he was a great promoter. He was a wonderful promoter. The Dixie Classic, first one was 1949. 49, the last one was 1960. I was actually on the team and redshirted when that was canceled because of a point shaving scandal, mm-hmm. but without getting into that, he was the one that really promoted that, had that idea. And for those that weren't familiar with the Dixie Classic, every year NC State, Duke, Carolina, Wake Forest were in it. They were the host teams, and then they would have four teams, hopefully the best four teams they could get. It was always between Christmas and New Year's. And every team that played would play three games. Somebody would win three games, somebody would lose three games, and so forth. But it would be consolation bracket. But he was great. And by the time I got there, he was not so much the X and O coach. I mean, he had the basic principles. And interesting thing about Everett Case, people thought of him as a gruff, you know, chewing you out, that sort of thing. But off the court, he was a totally different personality. He'd say, "How you doing, boy? You know, is everything going all right today, boy?" And all that kind of stuff. But very interesting person. But the last year I played, Press Maravich came up from Clemson as assistant coach. So there are a lot of sort of funny stories. But Press was doing a lot of the coaching. And one quick story, once we were having a practice and Everett Case got out and just chewed us out, you know, just said, "You guys aren't doing this, you're not doing that," and on and on and on. And then he said, "All right, Press, come go over that technical stuff." Go over the plays. And, you know, Les Robinson is one of my best friends. He was 1 year behind me. And one time, Everett Case, he taught, if you were throwing the ball around at the top of the key, if you got it from one side, you'd throw it to the other. And you swing it. But Press had a play called Sparkle. And Sparkle, if you call Sparkle, you get it at the top of the key and you throw it right back. So Les called Sparkle one time and he threw it right back, and Coach K stopped practice and said, "What are you doing, Robinson?" He said, "Sparkle, Coach." He said, "Sparkle my ass, get downstairs." So there was that sort of fun overlap with those two coaches. But Everett Case, my dad knew him extremely well, and I played football in high school and maybe did a little better in football than I did in basketball, but Everett called me over before my senior year in football and said he wanted me to play basketball at NC State and not to take a football scholarship. I was very flattered about that. And I did that, but I got injured, not to brag, but I played in the Shrine Bowl football game. I had a knee injury, didn't take an operation. And so I had a bad senior year in basketball, but he still... Once I started,
still kept you.
Yeah, he kept me, gave me a scholarship. Didn't play a lot, but played a lot in practice.
Yeah. Well, then quite a time to be there too. Had a chance to read your book, and the section about that is just fascinating. About everything that was happening in that time and the promotional side of it, and really how he built the culture of basketball as we know it here.
Yeah. He really did. And Atlantic Coast Conference, you know, NC State was in the Southern Conference. And then they went to the Atlantic Coast Conference. First year ACC was either 53 or 54. I think it might have been the 53.
I'm pretty sure it's 53.
Yeah, I think it's the 53-54 season.
I've seen that in the
logo.
Yeah,
I think it's the yeah. So anyway, that's when the ACC was formed. But he was very much behind that. And the Southern Conference had gotten up to like 18 teams. Mm-hmm. And George Washington was in it. A whole bunch of teams were in the Southern Conference. Davidson was nothing wrong with any of those schools, but they narrowed it down to eight.
You mentioned how the Glenwood Avenue headed out to the Angus Barn. Right. It's a small example of how you see bad areas of commerce and fast food sections and how that's not one. It's a small thing that helped Raleigh develop. What's something that Raleigh should be doing right now to help us be great in 50 years or 100 years from now?
There are a number of things, but it's across the board. In other words, we do need affordable workforce housing. That's very much a priority. We need that, okay? We need our transit system. And, of course, Wake County, as I heard it described by my buddy Joe Malazzo, is everybody going everywhere. So it's a little difficult, but with our bus guideway system, with commuter rail, that's possible. But also we need to continue to have more amenities. Dix Park is a great example of that, but greenways, cultural opportunities, restaurants. I mean, those are the kind of things that go. So it's not just one or two things. It's not, you say, here's a main objective. That's true, but you've got to support across the board. And we can become a greater city. And we will become a greater city, but we can't ignore. I mean, this Dix Park is one of the opportunity, not of a lifetime, of a generation.
Several generations.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's going to be done well.
So in your travels with the Urban Land Institute, because I know you're still heavily involved with that organization, mm-hmm. what things in other cities have you seen that you would like to see Raleigh adopt?
A lot of what we've sort of been talking about, I think the move to the urban core is happening all across the country. And you need to embrace that. You need to realize that people, if they can live close to where they work and where they have recreation, that's going to cut down. I'm always on traffic, and I'm always a little amazed when like there's a supermarket plan in a particular area, and people say they don't want the traffic. Well, the people that then would have gone to that supermarket are going to have to go travel a whole lot more. I mean, there's going to be a little more
traffic.
More traffic, actually. So to live closer to where you shop and all is a really good thing. But you know, I think Raleigh's got great opportunities. But in other cities, you see the same sort of positive things. I was in Nashville, ULI met in Nashville, and I think what they have done and what another thing we really need is the convention center hotel support. They have the Omni and a whole lot of hotels. Nashville's ahead of us in certain ways, so maybe you can look at that and say, maybe we should do that. There's an inner city visit that this chamber has every year. But I think others need to come see what we're doing as well. I don't think it's a matter of just feeling like, I don't know a city that really has a brighter future than we have. But you have to not only embrace it, you never arrive. You never get there. You never say, if we could just get this done and this done and this done. It's a journey with no end.
Sure. It's like you said earlier, if you're successful, you're growing. And if you're growing, you're successful.
That's right.
You've got a book out about growing up in Raleigh.
Growing up with Raleigh.
But it's about growing up in Raleigh, right?
Right.
And then I believe you have another book coming out. And I'm curious what made you decide you wanted to put some of these thoughts out in a book?
Well, the next book, let me just say first, is Raleigh, What We Remember. And it's going to be different in that it's going to have 20 plus interviews with different people that are essentially verbatim type interviews. The same author, John Sharp, who worked with on the first one, is doing it. But this one is going to be more related to the history of Raleigh, particularly the mid last century history in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And the first one we did was more about the cultural changes that have taken place in a community. Taking a trip around the United States for 6 weeks with no cell phones, the parents letting you do it, a 16-year-old, a 17-year-old, and four 18-year-olds, and just how that was done and that sort of thing. So this one is going to have more. For example, we have an interview with Wade Smith. He was very involved in the merger of the system, and he was in the legislature at the time.
The school system?
School system, yeah. The Wake County and the Raleigh school system. They were merged. Effective date was 1976, but it was done in 73. And there had actually been a referendum on merger that was defeated. So the six local representatives came back and put it in anyway. And one thing in Wade's interview, he said, what part of no didn't we understand? Was it the N or was it the O? You know? So, I mean, those kind of interviews. But then a lot of cross-section. Kendall Harris, who I saw this morning, the new Y, but Kendall works at the YMCA African American, late 40s. He grew up here in Raleigh. Just what he's seen.
Kendall.
Yeah, different people, women, African Americans, cross-section of people. And so I hope for people to open the book up and know somebody and read their interview. But the motivation for doing it, I can tell you, is not to make money. There's no way that I could possibly make any money on the books. But the idea is to contribute to the history of the community. And having grown up here and all, and I just want that. My dad did a book, and now we've done a book on my grandfather. But it's important when you go back and look at what happened. But eyewitness accounts, so to speak, in these interviews, is I think it'll be fairly interesting. We have Frank Daniels is in there, Goodman's in there, but it's not just people of that leadership level. It's It's a cross section.
We might have to use that book as a guideline for podcast guests. Like, let me see. Kendall Harris, yes. Goodman, yeah. Frank Daniels. Like, yeah, we'll just get them all on here.
But I think you're right. I mean, as Raleigh grows as fast as it does, we don't spend as much time talking about how we got here.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, like Philip Hortz is in the book. He has the, on Women of Street, you know, I think he calls it Reliable Loan.
But anyway, yeah, yeah.
He's a Jewish friend. He was in school with me and interview with him. I mean, it's just people from different, you would enjoy talking to Philip. He's a terrific, terrific guy.
No, we might do that. That's one of the best places to get an engagement ring,
yeah,
in Raleigh, I know.
Okay.
It's like one of the places you look at and you wouldn't think if you didn't know, but everybody goes there to get engagement rings. Yep.
But it just, so I mean, like 20 different interviews. And the hardest part has actually been, we want to have a section of pictures and of the people we've interviewed, and not a photo type, you know, portrait type look, but growing up, pictures of their youth, and so we'll have a whole section of those, so people can see what kids look like in those days.
And,
and when will it be released?
We're aiming for November at Quail Ridge Books, and we did the first one. John Sharp and I got together initially on September the 15th of 2009, and the book was published, and we introduced it at Quail Ridge Books on November the 3rd of 2014. That's 5 years. And then this one we started pretty much right after that, and so if this is 2019, that'll be five years.
Yeah.
It's perfect timing.
It takes a long time to do this, because it's not a matter of just writing something, it's a matter of what you write and how you write it, and does it really seem to work, and particularly lining up all these interviews. So that's our goal, but now it's September. I'm getting a little bit nervous. We've gotten the text is done. I mean, the writing is done.
Yeah.
So
just all
we got to
pieces.
Get it put together and published. Yeah. And we got the cover designed. The cover is, of course, again, the title, Raleigh, what we remember. But the cover is a picture of me and Billy Dunlap. He's one of the interviewees. He's the one that started hospice. He's a doctor. In a little boat that we built, a little rowboat type, on Lake Boone. And we were in college.
Trained.
Yeah, we were in college. So what we remember, if you reflect on that picture, we remember a lake that's no longer there.
Yeah,
yeah, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
It's a great picture.
Yeah.
Candid type picture.
Anything else?
Anything else that we should know about, learn about?
I would just say that we've got to improve and work toward improving, you know, every single day. You know, just like any individual can build a legacy and then they can mess it up overnight. And that's not what we want to happen. So city council elections are very important. Not to talk about particular candidates, but it's very, very important to set the tone for a city. County commissioners is important as well, but not as much related to the urban fabric of what's happening here. Right in Raleigh, although the county, we're all in the county as well as in the city, so we got a great future, but it's not automatic.
Thanks so much for the time.
Well,
and,
I enjoyed it.
And not just your short hour here, but all the years of helping Raleigh be the great city it is.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for listening to Podcast Raleigh. Review us on your favorite podcast app. If you like this episode, share it with a friend.